ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Wednesday, the 14th of January. I'm Stephanie Smale, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Today, new federal hate laws under fire with claims the rushed legislation will have unintended consequences. And from fires in Victoria to flooding in Queensland. Hear from the Australians grappling with the fallout from extreme weather.
We know of at least two families that have basically lost everything bar the car they left in and the clothes on their back. A lot of our families have lost, you know, sheds and infrastructure and livestock. So, I mean, at the moment, you know, who really knows the full toll?
The death toll in Iran has increased significantly, with at least 2,000 people killed in the bloody crackdown by security forces. The United States is urging its citizens to leave Iran immediately. And the US President, Donald Trump, has told anti-regime protesters that help is on its way. Rachel Hayter reports.
Help is on its way. The US President Donald Trump has foreshadowed in a Truth Social post that American intervention in Iran is imminent. Iranian patriots, he writes, keep protesting. Take over your institutions. Save the names of the killers and abusers. They will pay a big price. I've cancelled all meetings with Iranian officials until the senseless killing of protesters stops. But what form that help could take is unclear. Reporters tried to glean details from the president at a US airbase in Maryland.
So are you committing not to sending US troops into Iran?
Why would I tell you that? I don't talk about military strategy with a reporter, you know?
But he has confirmed what he'd like to result from US intervention.
We don't want to see people killed, and we want to see a little bit of freedom for these people. These people have been living in hell for a long time.
A growing number of Iranians are paying the ultimate price for speaking out against their government. The US-based group Human Rights Activist News Agency says it's verified the deaths of more than 2,000 people. Some experts believe the true number is far higher. And while a government-enforced internet blackout has stemmed the flow of information, some is leaking out. Negin Shirakai is an Iranian-British activist and founder of the Azadi Network, which supports Iranian minority groups. Today, she spoke with her 80-year-old mother inside Iran, who's angry at the bloodshed.
She's seen a lot of death, especially the young teenagers. We also heard it from human rights organizations, and the number is much higher because a lot of people are inside their houses with injuries because they're scared to go to the hospital. As soon as someone's going to the hospital, the security forces kidnap them.
As the US president continues to ramp up his rhetoric, what kind of intervention or attack could be coming? Alex Vitanka is a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington. He believes a full-blown American military response is unlikely.
That, to me, is probably the last thing the U.S. would do, other than very kind of specific targeting in terms of the IRGC, that's the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, or the security forces that are known to be engaged in actual killing.
He thinks U.S. action will be more indirect.
U.S. has offensive cyber capabilities that can slow down the repressive machinery of the regime.
He also warns any American intervention risks a nationalist backlash from the Iranian population.
The best case scenario is that the regime is toppled by its own people without the United States having to get involved in anything that is significant, because if that happens politically, that starts putting pressure on Trump back home here with his supporters.
A number of European governments have summoned their respective Iranian ambassadors over the regime's bloody crackdown. Meanwhile, the US is urging American citizens to leave Iran immediately.
Rachel Hayter reporting. The Iraqi government says exiled Victorian gangland boss Kazem Hamad has been arrested for alleged drug importation and smuggling. Iraqi authorities say the arrest has been made on behalf of Australian law enforcement, alleging Hamad to be one of the most dangerous wanted men in the world. Hamad is a key person of interest in Melbourne's deadly tobacco wars that spread to South and Western Australia. For more, I spoke with ABC reporter David Estcourt a short time ago. David, Kazem Hamad was deported from Australia in 2023. What do we know about his alleged activities since then?
Steph, police suspect that he is the kingpin and the central figure of the illicit tobacco trade operating in Melbourne and, as you mentioned, that has spread to other states like South Australia and Western Australia. Police think that he's been running this syndicate from Iraq since his extradition from Australia back in July 2023 following a heroin trafficking conviction. Police believe that after he arrived back in Iraq, he used local contacts back in Australia to establish what is perhaps the most sophisticated and lucrative illicit tobacco and vape importation scheme in Australia. Police suspect that it's worth, you know, billions of dollars and that it has lots of other aspects to it, like extortion of local tobacco sellers and setting up of multiple shops that belong to the syndicate. His crew are also known for their fierce retribution against syndicate rivals and those who refuse to pay money under what police suspect were widespread extortion schemes, and these activities were often linked to firebombings and in some cases killings, though obviously Kazem Hamad has not been charged with anything linked to his time in Iraq.
So how significant is this development then?
If what Iraqi authorities are saying is true, Steph, it marks a major disruption to the illicit tobacco trade and the so-called tobacco war, which has raged in Melbourne and possibly other states for the last few years. And not only that, of course, during a recent Senate estimates hearing, AFP Commissioner Chrissy Barrett said Hamad presented a national security threat to Australia for his involvement in this tobacco trade, for his alleged links to violent acts like firebombings and his suspected involvement in the firebombing of the Adas Israel synagogue in December 2024, which listeners might recall, ASIO believe was carried out on behalf of the Iranian government. Additionally, experts also suspect that Hamad's trade and alleged extortion could be worth in the billions of dollars. And so given how many illicit tobacco outlets there are and local demand for cheap nicotine products, so it is a very, very significant development.
So David, what's likely to happen next? Will Hamad be extradited to Australia?
Police and the government haven't confirmed if they're going to seek extradition, Steph. It's unclear whether Hamad will be prosecuted here or in Iraq. Obviously, that process is very complex. Jurisdictionally, arrests are difficult in Iraq. As well, there were fears a while ago that if Australian authorities shared information with their Iraqi counterparts, that they might attempt to execute him. Obviously, that hasn't happened in this case if they have him in custody. But one aspect that stands out from perhaps the entire incident is that law enforcement did find themselves in a bind in how to deal with Hamad. Allegedly, he was a very prominent and powerful crime boss carrying out acts of really serious violence from a distance in Iraq, and that was beyond the reach of police. And it's meant that as long as he could orchestrate this empire from afar, it would continue to grow relatively unabated. And Victoria Police and Federal Police were forced to pursue local members of his syndicate here in Melbourne without ever tracing that arrest or making that arrest up to Hamad. And whilst Hamad was in Iraq, he was believed to be living in a heavily fortified safe house or compound, which provided him with security. So the fact that the Iraqi police have made this arrest and the fact that it is set to disrupt an international syndicate that has had really profound implications on the ground in Australia, I think will be of massive relief to the federal government, who have always been very reluctant to resile from their heavy tobacco tax, which many criminologists believe was feeding into the violence that we were seeing on the streets related to the purchase and distribution of cheap tobacco.
David Estcourt there. A US State Department official has weighed into the debate about Australia's proposed hate speech laws, calling them clumsy. Labor's draft bill allows for a narrow defence against racial hate speech when referencing or directly quoting a religious text for the purpose of teaching or discussion. But there's broad concern the laws would protect some communities from hate but leave others out. Angus Randall reports.
Less than 24 hours on, the federal government's proposed hate speech laws have begun to get international attention. In a social media post, US State Department Undersecretary Sarah Rogers worries a narrow exclusion for those who quote religious texts could protect extremists. We've voiced her comments.
A statute that imprisons you for calling to deport jihadist extremists but provides safe harbour if you are a jihadist extremist would be deeply perverse. Let's hope this isn't what Australia intends.
There's been criticism of the proposals from across the political spectrum. Nationals MP Bridget McKenzie says she only saw the around 500-page piece of legislation yesterday.
He's lumped migration changes in with the management of firearms and obviously in with hate speech laws. So there's a lot to unpack and not enough time before we debate it to actually get that those opinions from the experts, etc., about the impact.
Labor MP Josh Burns says the government's goal is simple: to make everyone feel safe.
This is a long-term effort by the government and by authorities and institutions to ensure that people can just go about their lives and live safely for who they are.
The bill allows for a narrow defence against racial hate speech accusations on the grounds of referencing or directly quoting a religious text for the purpose of religious teaching or discussion. Professor Emerita Anne Toomey is a constitutional expert at the University of Sydney.
The legislation is long, it is technical, and it is difficult, and there is some quite weird stuff in there. So I can see how they might describe it as clumsy, although I suspect they probably haven't been reading the detail.
The proposed law is only putting limits on hatred based on race, colour, national or ethnic origin. And Toomey believes the narrow defence allowing an exception for discussion of religious texts is reasonable.
It's not about going out and proselytising and encouraging people to, you know, commit acts of violence or hatred against others, etc. So I think it is very narrow. And it's the same as what's in the New South Wales legislation, and no one, you know, got excited about it then.
Her concerns are more around the speed of this legislation causing problems down the road.
Well, they're more likely to be challenged than to be struck down. That's the reality.
The Executive Council of Australian Jewry says it's optimistic about the new reforms, but the President of the Australian Federation of Islamic Councils, Dr. Rateb Janaid, has serious concerns about the pace of these reforms. In a statement, he wonders who from the Muslim community was consulted on the proposed laws and says there are several red flags, including the risk that some communities could be unfairly targeted. Civil liberties groups are also worried. Gemma Caffarella is the president of Liberty Victoria.
The government has announced a royal commission into addressing the causes of the Bondi massacre and also into anti-Semitism. And yet, before that royal commission has had a chance to do any work, is bringing in these incredibly poorly considered and draconian measures before there's been any proper examination of these issues.
There have already been flow-on effects from the proposed hate speech laws. The neo-Nazi National Socialist Network says it will disband over concerns its members would be arrested and charged. Labor's Josh Burns is glad to see them gone.
If the legislation announcement that we have brought has meant that they are disbanding and that is the end of their activity, well, that is a fundamentally good thing.
Parliament returns to debate the hate speech, gun law and migration bill on Monday.
Angus Randall reporting. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Victorian firefighters are still battling 11 major fires across the state as authorities brace for more hot weather and the cleanup continues. At Longwood in the state's north, emergency crews are still working to extinguish a blaze and clear roads so residents can begin to rebuild. Locals and volunteers are helping those impacted, delivering packages of support to those who can't reach the relief centres. Kathleen O'Connor has been travelling through some of the worst affected regions.
We're just driving through the town of Harcourt at the moment, and the devastation is just, it's immense. You've got damaged fences everywhere you look. You've got damaged sheds, homes, trees down. It's just absolutely devastating.
The fire came really close to our house. It's just really sad and devastating.
13 minutes down the road, Castlemaine is a relief centre for those impacted by the fires. Husband and wife Satoko and Hiro Tasaki are from Harcourt.
Our house is okay and our court is all houses and the court is okay. But the other part of the town is really sad. So many houses gone and then a lot of black the lands. And then there's a really good cafe in Harcourt. We love that cafe, but the cafe's gone.
Peter Breyer is a Lions Club volunteer.
We're just cooking hamburgers and sausages for the local community is in there.
While the fire emergency is over for now, multiple fires are still burning across the state. About 100 kilometres northeast in Longwood, locals are pitching in to help support the firefighting efforts. Trucks are coming in and out, transporting essentials to those who can't reach the relief centre. Damon Roussett is the CFA incident controller.
We're really moving into recovery and quickly, trying to get resources into the areas where the locals are driving hay and food and supplies and things like that. As quick as they get stuff into the Ruffey Hall, within half an hour it's gone.
Rick Shiner is president of local netball club, the Longwood Redlegs.
Our netball girls, it kicked it all off, and you know, obviously situations like this, you know, people are wanting to feed firefighters and do those sorts of things. So we went down the path of providing towels and just shower kits and just trying to make them feel probably a little bit more human when they get back in off the fire ground and to just refresh and recharge.
They've also set up a donation centre in their netball shed where people have delivered clothes, toiletries, nappies and other items.
It's basically like a mini supermarket in our meeting room and netball shed.
Travis Stefanos is the principal of Longwood Primary School. He says many staff members sheltered others during the ferocious blaze.
Another staff member had taken a family and her children up to her place. She'd also taken their horses and another family, that staff member that ended up losing their home, she went up there as well with her three kids as well. It's not just about the loss of their families' homes or the buildings as such. It's probably more around just that unsettled nature that we've had to deal with for 3 days. Plus, temperatures are plus 40 degrees with no aircon is pretty stressful regardless.
He's now focusing on how to help kids process the traumatic experience.
We've done a lot of work in the last 4 or 5 years in regards to empowering our students with the correct language about emotions and feelings, being feeling okay, I guess, to be anxious or to be worried or to be scared and let them know that that's okay. But then to refocus in on the things that have been amazing, like the CFA, the SES, the fact that all the volunteers have come together in a small community to help.
Longwood Primary School Principal Travis Stefanos ending that report from Kathleen O'Connor. Communities in Queensland are angry they didn't get enough warning about the threat of major flooding as ex-tropical cyclone Koji moved west. A major clean-up is underway at Clermont in central Queensland, where more than 70 properties have been damaged by floodwaters. Stock losses across western Queensland have surged past 50,000, as Alexandra Humphreys reports.
Joe Masters wades through ankle-deep muddy floodwaters as he walks through his home in Clermont. He'd left to run a quick errand on Monday, not realising the threat that was coming.
And it was rising rapidly. Like I said, within half an hour, we were gone. The next time we come back, we could not even get into our property through the roads. So it was pretty scary, actually.
He rushed to evacuate his four children and their grandparents and has now returned to assess the damage.
Quite devastating, the amount of damage that was done from the water going through all of our electrical appliances, the beds. We had 3 bedrooms downstairs. They're all gone. We had a bathroom that's gone. Devastating amount of damage that's caused by water.
Floodwaters rapidly swept through the town of Clermont earlier this week, forcing locals to flee. Ex-tropical cyclone Koji dumped more than 200 millimetres of rainfall on the central Queensland town, the heaviest rainfall in more than a century. Isaac Regional Council Mayor Kelly Vivi says 71 properties have been damaged by floodwaters, but the final tally may be higher.
We've got a couple in there that are
really severe, but those assessments will continue as access continues to open.
Mayor Vivi says Clermont locals are used to significant rains, but the scale of this disaster caught many off guard.
What we've never seen is the water rise so quickly and so much rain saturation in one day. A lot of our communities had their largest rainfall in history. It was just a huge impact that we weren't expecting to that extent.
Queensland Premier David Crisafulli claims long-term underinvestment in the Bureau of Meteorology has left regional Queenslanders exposed.
Across all political persuasions in Canberra, I don't think there has been the investment in the Bureau that's needed. And on the back of it, residents are sitting ducks in many cases and we are flying blind.
The Premier pledged to work with councils and the Commonwealth to help residents recover in Clermont and across Western Queensland, where farmers have been dealing with a weeks-long ordeal.
And I look to the west of the state and there's some real challenges there. You know, we've got now over 50,000 livestock that have perished, and that figure is going to grow significantly.
Janine Fegan is the mayor of McKinley Shire Council in Queensland's west, where floodwaters have been impacting primary producers.
It's pretty significant and pretty horrendous. Cattle a week, they're trying to walk through heavy soil. Some are perishing because where they were on dry land and where the waters have receded, but then they've got to try and get to the water now. So it's going to be a long recovery process.
The Mayor of the McKinley Shire Council, Janine Fegan, ending Alexandra Humphrey's report. They're the crown jewels of Australia's nature tourism, but national parks are being choked by rubbish. From nappies to food scraps and even desks and chairs, the protected areas are constantly needing a clean-up. It's an expensive issue for park staff and a headache for locals. Luke Radford takes a look.
Waterfall Gully is the beating heart of Adelaide's national parks. It's easily accessible from the city, and the walking track from the base to the summit of Mount Lofty is by far South Australia's most popular. But like many wild places, it can't escape rubbish.
Our main issues are people leaving their drink bottles. We do get a lot of coffee cups and drink bottles left around the toilet.
Brent Loris is a senior ranger and acting district manager for the Adelaide and Mount Lofty Rangers. He's picked up his fair share of litter, and drink bottles are far from the worst thing he's had to deal with.
One of the issues we have at Blair is people coming in with their dogs and they'll pick up after their dog and then they'll just toss the doggy bag on the side of the trail or tie it up in a tree.
For more than a decade, the South Australian National Park Service have been running an anti-littering campaign called Leave No Trace. And as part of that, authorities made what, on the surface at least, seems like a strange decision. Get rid of the bins.
Over a decade ago, there were bins in some parks and just led to lots of increased issues with build-up of rubbish and wildlife getting into the bins and the impact on the wildlife. So, a decision was made to remove bins and it's been pretty successful.
Keeping rubbish out of national parks is a battle that stretches far beyond just Adelaide. The Great Barrier Reef is one of the world's greatest natural wonders and is visited by more than 2 million people every year. But even it isn't immune. Heidi Tate is the CEO and founder of the Tangaroa Blue Foundation, which works to prevent and remove marine debris.
If we go to Cape York, we do our beach cleanups up there, we find a lot of pool noodles. And you think, wow, that is such a weird item to find in the middle of nowhere up in Cape York. But if you look at the ocean currents, there are direct predominant winds that come from some of the reefs off Cairns and Port Douglas. And we know that the tour operators use these pool noodles to assist people that are going to be snorkeling and swimming on the Great Barrier Reef during tours. So it's amazing actually how much gets accidentally lost rather than that deliberate loss.
So what can actually be done? How can Australia stem the tide of rubbish in our most pristine places? Well, one source of inspiration could be found in Tasmania. It's not led by a government or a charity. Rather, it came from a bushwalk-loving artist.
Our sticker came out and sort of gave people an option, something that they could say, this a little beacon that they could put on their car saying, I care about the environment.
That's Josh Pringle, the founder of Keep Tassie Wild. It began as a series of stickers protesting against development in national parks, but it's since grown to represent the broader goal of protecting and caring for Tasmania's wilderness. Josh Pringle is the first to admit that litter and pollution in national parks is still a big issue in Tasmania, and a few stickers aren't going to magically fix it. But he also says Keep Tassie Wild is a model that can be replicated anywhere, and every bit of recognition helps.
I think it just takes one person really, and then for people to get on board and for it to be a message that resonates, I suppose. I know that in the Northern Rivers, there's a group called Revive the Northern Rivers, and they were inspired by Keep Tassie Wild. So I reckon if people kind of realise the impact that, and that there's a path forward, it can happen.
Keep Tassie Wild founder Josh Pringle, that report by Luke Radford. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Stephanie Smail.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Board members quit, the chairman and then the director stepped down, and almost 200 participants pulled out. And so this year's Adelaide Writers' Week is no longer. Today, Dennis Muller from the Centre for Advancing Journalism at Melbourne Uni on the damage that's been done and what it means for free speech. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.